Hello, Pittsburgh. I'm Zach Gibson, and this is Trib Lives from the Newsroom, a podcast bringing you top stories from triblive.com. In the summer of 2023, Jonathan Fadley, a U.S. Army veteran from Somerset County, found himself in an unimaginable situation. After learning from the news that his father, 59-year-old Robbie Saunders, had been fatally shot by the police in Ligonier Valley, Fadley sought answers. Saunders, who was disabled and had a history of substance abuse, had been holding a machete on his own porch when the incident occurred. Fadley's quest for clarity led him to the local police station, but according to him, all he encountered was silence and evasiveness. Despite his repeated attempts to obtain crucial information, including a police report, body cam footage, and statements from those involved, he was met with resistance. Westmoreland County District Attorney Nicole Ziccarelli's office, while eventually releasing some information in response to an open records request, left Fadley feeling stonewalled and neglected. Joining me today is reporter Justin Vellucci to explore the challenges faced by Fadley in his search for answers and the broader implications of transparency in law enforcement. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Zach. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me today. To get us started, can you just give us an overview of the Fadley situation? Tell us what happened.
Sure. Police in Ligonier Valley, which is a regional department out in Westmoreland County, responded to a call. I believe it was domestic disturbance. And when they arrived on scene, they approached the house. There apparently had been previous encounters with Saunders, and he came to the front door wielding a machete. There were two officers. One officer attempted to tase Saunders, and the other officer fired, I believe it was one shot, and struck him in the chest.
It's my understanding that his son found this out over the news and had to try and figure out what happened after that, yes?
Yeah, that's correct.
So can you tell me a little bit about the article you wrote? I understand that this is just one section of your larger exclusive.
It's tough to come up with these numbers. There is no central database that records the number of police killings in America. Obviously, it's a very politically charged issue, but it's one where the numbers, objectively speaking, the numbers are up. Last year in the United States, police killed, I believe it was 1,247. I mean, we're talking nearly 1,300 people. You know, I do not have numbers at my fingertips as to how many were deemed justified. What I can tell you is that from the data that's being tracked, it looks like officers were named in about 10% of those instances, which I want to make statements, but that's a small number. Right. Fewer than 1% were facing any criminal charges. So these are numbers that, you know, as a reporter who's regularly dealing with people involved in shootings and things like this, involved in following, you know, police pressing charges, you know, those are some interesting numbers to get your head around.
Right. And we will get back into those numbers in a little bit. Now let's focus in on the Fadley situation. With this challenge of transparency going on with these types of incidents, in your interviews, Fadley discussed the difficulties that he faced in obtaining information about the shooting. Can you tell me about that conversation? What did he tell you?
He was very concerned. I mean, he had expressed concerns to the media when the shooting occurred last year. Obviously, it's been a good year now, and he still has no answers. He had gone in person from Somerset County to Westmoreland County twice, I believe it was, on the day of the shooting and then shortly thereafter. And both times, officers just flat out refused to speak with him. They would not give him a police report. They would not explain, a narrative of what had happened. They essentially just confirmed that an officer had shot his father.
Okay. In your story, there is a quote from Fadley that says, and quote, "We were stonewalled every which way. No names, no nothing. Never saw a report, never touched one. I wanted a police report. I wanted the body cam footage. I wanted statements. I wanted it all. And all they gave me was the runaround." Now, reading this, one can understand the types of frustration that somebody would go through in this. Now, like I said, for this article, Fadley was only one of the situations you reported on. Throughout this process, you've gotten to see what it looks like when loved ones don't get their answers. How can that lack of transparency from the police and a DA's office affect a family's ability to seek justice or closure?
Sometimes it's little details, but sometimes it's very practical. I know, for example, Susan Shepherd was living with her son, Christopher Shepherd, in Upper St. Clair when he was fatally shot by police. I believe it was January 7th of 2024. She was sitting in a squad car nearby at the time he was shot. My understanding is they were rushed back to the police department before they even knew, you know, what had happened. She now lives alone in that house, and she relied on, you know, money from Chris to, you know, make her way. She's an older woman. She could not collect on his life insurance policy without a police report, and the Upper St. Clair police repeatedly refused to give her one.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little detail, but I mean, this is what these families are going through, in addition to having to process the unexpected loss of a loved one. You know, they're dealing with these very real situations and wanting, very frankly, to just have a day in court to hear, you know, the different versions of what happened and why.
Mm-hmm. We also know that in that situation with Shepherd, her half-sister, Michelle Kippelin, had a similar situation where communication was difficult to acquire, I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, she wanted answers. She also lives in Upper St. Clair. She explained that her, you know, she refers to him as her brother, not her half-brother, but, she, you know, her brother had numerous interactions with the Upper St. Clair police, including recently, I believe, you know, I'd have to check the information, but I believe it was since November of 23, he had been involuntarily committed to psychiatric facilities, I want to say two or three times, or maybe January was the third time. So these officers had been there. They were aware of his mental health issues. They were aware he was someone who would, you know, need to be involuntarily committed. Again, though, you know, the police will not release records as to why the police chief, for example, called in a SWAT team. They make these claims about the knife. You know, Chris Shepherd, but per the police version, Chris Shepherd had a knife when he approached officers. Police won't answer any questions about how far he was from the officers. Even in the sworn statements that we got when we took this to Harrisburg, the details were very unclear. Every police chief gave sort of a slightly different version of the story. And this is more information that we're getting than the family is.
Wow. So in all of these types of requests for information, body cam footage, or reports, these families are oftentimes left with nothing but the questions they started with. So let's look at the stats in this piece. In your article, you cite from the nonprofit group Mapping Police Violence, where they say that just under 13,000, 1,247 people were killed by police in America last year, which according to them is a record. In roughly 86% of these cases, the officers were not named. As you stated earlier, even a very, very small amount were facing criminal charges. But these numbers are an interesting gauge, is a way that I could word it, because there is no central database for these types of statistic.
Right. The thing that is interesting, and I don't know how much the public knows this stuff versus, you know, this is just sort of a language that reporters speak. Police officers are named all the time. Police's names are in criminal complaints. For every, you know, charge they file, you know, they're named when there's a car accident and there's a report taken about it. You know, if the Fraternal Order of Police, which represents Pittsburgh Police, for example, if they were having a ceremony, which they do to honor, you know, good service, the officer's named. But the second, you know, there's a shooting or a fatal shooting, suddenly it's, oh, no, can't give you the name. Can't give you the name. No information. And that's interesting. I mean, as someone who sort of relies on this information to tell these stories, it's interesting that we know the names of the victims. We know the ages of the victims. We have information about their criminal records. We have information on Chris Shepherd's psychiatric commitments, for example. And that's not even coming from the family. But we know nothing about the four men from three different departments that shot at him that night.
Wow. Well, again, back to these statistics, the percentage of these cases where officers were named slid to 14% last year, which is down from 39% in 2020. So it seems like this situation is getting even more prevalent.
Yeah, and the one thing that's interesting, and you know, I'm not a legal expert. I cover crime and public safety more than I cover the courts. But the one thing that's interesting is the State Office of Open Records, for example, as these numbers of officer-involved shootings, as they call them, has gone up in Pennsylvania, in southwestern Pennsylvania, nationally. Here in Pennsylvania, the Office of Open Records has been increasingly denying requests for access to that information. And very frequently, they're citing this issue of officer safety. The thing that's interesting, though, is that there is no need for specifics. So if a police department says, oh, yep, our officers are in danger, essentially that shields them, because of Pennsylvania's open records laws, from being named.
Wow. Let's talk about the impact of delayed or denied information. What did Fadley have to say as far as the emotional and psychological toll due to the stonewalling he experienced?
Fadley had I mean, he's a survivor. He's a tough go. He was the oldest of three children that Robbie Saunders had. His parents were very young. They were teenagers when his mother gave birth to him, from very different backgrounds. So there was a lot of family tension from the get-go. He and his siblings went into foster care at age 9. So the connection to the family has been tough. It's been tough. It's not your traditional, you know, nuclear family, two working parents, you know, white picket fence, etc. And I think that sort of further complicates things. He went into the military. He excelled, but he also came out very physically banged up. As a result, he does not work. He survives on disability. He has a lot of time day to day. And for him to sort of have, you know, his mother died several years ago, for him to sort of lose that connection to his parents so tragically, it really, it's tough on him.
In your article, you also pointed to the same type of theme of disappointment in Susan Shepherd's case. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Susan is, she has lived a more conventional, more typical, a more comfortable life. Upper St. Clair is a pretty affluent community here in Pittsburgh, South Hills, in Allegheny County. Her experience is much different than Fadley's. But, you know, like I said, the life insurance, this is someone she was living with. I mean, she was living with her son. They relied on each other. He also had difficulty with work. Right? He was, you know, he was volunteering a lot, but this is someone who she relied on, and he's gone now, and she's living alone, and, you know, she has no support. I mean, it's tough. There are challenges both in terms of the practical, you know, the money, the housing situations, whatever, but also the emotional. I mean, this is an older woman who lost her 40-something-year-old son, who battled mental health issues for decades through something she was looking to the police to help, and this is what happened. Hmm.
You said something there that I wanted to highlight, looking to the police for help. Now, what do you think, or in your reporting experience, have you seen concerns of a deterioration in the trust or confidence in law enforcement with these situations?
It really depends on who you talk to and when. I mean, listen, there are good cops. Fact. Like, there are good police officers. There's good police leadership in certain municipalities, for sure. And there are certain communities that have great relationships with the officers who walk the beat there. It's just that, unfortunately, like these are the situations that get a lot of focus, get a lot of attention. I mean, you know, the fact that, and I think experts said this for the story, the fact that there's this increasing trend of sort of secrecy, you know, of hiding behind the badge, it does not bode well for the relationship that the police, you know, have with families who live in their communities.
Okay. Now, in this increasing trend of secrecy, how has that impacted your job as a reporter? I know that through this story specifically, we submitted open records requests, and that is a process that at times can be arduous. Can you lay out that process for us and tell me how it's been impacted in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, I started working at the Trib my first time in 2006, and even then till now, the interaction between law enforcement and reporters is dramatically different. I'm sure we could do a whole conversation just about public information officers and the challenges those roles present, and there's all sorts of legal discussions. I mean, it's a whole separate thing, but police are guarded about certain information. If there is public paperwork, listen, I mean, I pull criminal complaints, which have police narratives about crimes every day. And there are certain things that they are very good about access. But if a department wants to circle the wagons and block information, it's not hard to do. With our right to know request, you file, you know, either in person, you fill out a form, sometimes by mail. A lot of departments allow you to email them now. You're waiting 30 days. If they ask for an extension, you're waiting 35. In the Shepherd case, for example, we started filing this paperwork, you know, shortly after the shooting in January. And, you know, you're sending right to know requests to three separate municipalities and three separate police forces. And then you're sending it to Upper St. Clair, the town in which it took place. And, you know, request after request after request, especially in the Shepherd case, was denied. From, you know, what is the name of the officer? What is the rank of the officer? Can you give me any information on the disciplinary history against the officer? I mean, from basic stuff like that down to the SHACOG, which is the group that funds this regional SWAT team in the Shepherd case. They flat out, they wouldn't give us applications to join the group. They would not identify officers who presently or previously served, who might or might not have even been there on the day Shepherd was shot. I mean, it's just been, you know, if they can find a legal reason, they will hold it up and they will work what they need to work to stop the information from getting out.
Interesting. Well, in this case, there was eventually some type of reprieve where we were able to get some information. Can you tell me about that and the effect it had on this story?
So in the Fadley case, there in Westmoreland County, there was the release of some body cam footage. Fadley maintains it's very selective, and obviously it's from, you know, the officer's body cam, so it's where the officer's standing. But it does show the officers, you know, interacting with the person outside the house, going up the stairs. I mean, it shows, you know, where the officer was standing. He was standing at the bottom of a stairwell. He was not within arm's length of Saunders. Saunders did not swing a knife at him. They did not try to disarm Saunders. But still, you know, it shows that, you know, the situation. And that was critical. I mean, I think that, you know, just as someone who believes in public access, I think the fact that the Ligonier Township and Borough released this sort of thing is commendable. And I think the chief even came out at that time and said, listen, the video speaks for itself. And I think it does. I think it shows a man who was in the midst of some sort of crisis, who, you know, he did come to the door with a knife.
Okay. Now, as I said in the introduction, the Westmoreland County District Attorney ruled that it was a justified incident. Taking a look back at Fadley, something we haven't really dug too deeply into is his status as a U.S. Army veteran.
That's correct.
In his search for answers, with the lack that he's gotten from what he might have expected to serve what he feels is justice. How does his experience and sense of duty shape his expectations in his responses during your interview?
Yeah, Fadley, you know, I don't have the years in front of me. He served when the U.S. went into Iraq in 2003. He was an infantryman. He was, in his words, the guy, you know, kicking down doors and looking for the bad guys. And it took a physical toll on him. I mean, today he wears braces on both legs. He had to have eye surgery, which requires him to wear sunglasses at all times. I mean, he kind of, you know, it took a toll. But the one thing he sort of says, and he draws these parallels quite often, is that he had in Iraq, you know, rules of engagement. You know, what someone who comes close to you holding a knife, you know, what do you do? And, you know, he is very clear that, in his opinion, the officers that shot at his father would not have, you know, been able to do that in a war zone. He's very clear, and he criticizes the training. That's obviously part of it. But he says, you know, if I were in Iraq and someone came at me with a knife, I wouldn't have just been able to, you know, open fire willy-nilly. I mean, that's you know, his exact words.
So looking at the decision ruling it a justified incident, what are some of the implications of the DA's decision? And have you heard of concerns from those you've interviewed in this or other stories of similar incidences that kind of tell of a trend or precedent when faced with this situation?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, the DA out in Westmoreland County ruled it justified. Essentially, that means that the officers involved in the shooting will not be charged criminally. You know, I'd love to ask the DA some questions. I mean, the DA flat out will not get on the phone to talk about this. And it's the same thing in Allegheny County. In the Shepherd case, for example, we heard nothing. The DA said nothing. We did not know if there were charges. We knew nothing. We took the right to know denials to Harrisburg. We said, we're appealing. Like, we're not, you know, letting you block us out like this. We took it to Harrisburg, and the individual police chiefs from the individual departments had to give essentially sworn statements explaining, you know, what happened that night and why the record shouldn't be released. In the fine print, in their sworn statements, they said, oh, by the way, you know, DA's pal in Allegheny County said this was justified. And we're moving on. And it was like, well, hold on a second. So we found out that the DA had ruled this justified, allegedly. We're guessing the DA still won't talk about it. But we're finding out he deemed this justified only because we went to Harrisburg to fight this denial of records.
That is an interesting part of the job, to say the least.
And again, open records laws. Pennsylvania does not have a cap on how long you can say an investigation is active and use that as a reason to block records. So if Zappala or Zaccarelli or any DA, if any law enforcement officer doesn't want to answer questions about Chris Shepherd or Robbie Saunders or Greg Carlson or Selwyn Brown, I mean, I could go on and on. They don't have to. The case could go on for 100 years. They will never have to release records, and that's because of open record laws in Pennsylvania.
Wow. So before we wrap up, I want to ask, what does all of this mean for the broader conversation of police use of force, especially in these officer-involved shootings with individuals with disabilities, specifically here in Western Pennsylvania?
It's a tough conversation. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, to be fair, people are increasingly violent. There are a lot more guns in America in 2024 than there were 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 40 years ago. So officers, especially those who walk the beat, like, they have to face people who are armed, who are oftentimes violent, and more violent than they were when these officers were trained or grew up in a lot of these towns. I think that needs to be said. Like, you know, it's very easy to say, you know, the police are more violent or they're killing more people. Like, yes, everyone is more violent. That's understood. The thing that's concerning is there's a number of people, and I can't cite the stats off the top of my head, like Christopher Shepherd, who have mental health issues, or Robbie Saunders, who have, you know, a history of substance abuse and a long history of interacting with the police, who, because of unpredictability, let's say, are being shot, are being involved in these sorts of things. It's going to happen. Like, I understand, and I'm not the one to say, you know, whether it's right or wrong or justified or not justified or whatever, that these things happen. What's interesting, though, is that when these things happen, the response is increasingly to tell the public, to tell the media, and by extension the public, as little as possible. And that's the concern.
Okay. Well, Justin, thank you for coming on to explain this situation and give us a preview of your Trib Live exclusive.
Sounds good. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining. If you enjoyed this week's episode, share the podcast to help keep Western PA locally informed with insightful discussion and the latest news from your area. It's an easy way to spread the word, and it helps our podcast reach more people like you. Don't forget to follow us on Spotify and turn on episode notifications so you never miss new content. Once again, I'm Zach Gibson, and this is From the Newsroom.